From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Last Thursday, the gavel came down on the Supreme Court confirmation hearings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. If confirmed, she would be the first black woman justice on the nation's highest court. She would also be the first justice in a generation with significant experience doing criminal defense work, at least since Thurgood Marshall retired in 1991. Presiding over the hearings was Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, who's chairman of the Judiciary Committee. In his opening statements on the third day of the hearings, Durbin criticized his Republican colleagues like Senators Ted Cruz of Texas and Tom Cotton of Arkansas for using the hearings as an opportunity to score political points by dog whistling to their voters.
Your nomination turned out to be a testing ground for conspiracy theories and culture war theories. The more bizarre the charges against you and your family, the more I understand the social media scoreboard lit up yesterday. I'm sorry that we have to go through this. These are not theories that are in the mainstream of America, but they have been presented here as such.
Here to talk more about the hearings is Lynn Sweet, Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times. Lynn, welcome back to the 21st Show. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can join us as ever, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Let's get right to it. So Senator Durbin's been through a lot of these confirmation hearings, about four decades in Congress at this point. But this was his first time in the center chair. How did he handle the hearings?
Well, given the anticipated incoming from the Republicans, he did well. He did not do anything on his end to be inflammatory, which was important because he didn't want to jeopardize his potential of getting at least a few Republican votes from Republicans in and out of the committee. And if you're trying to figure out why, in some ways, did he just let the handful of senators on the committee kind of go on and on without him engaging in a combustible way, this is why. One part of his role that I thought was noteworthy is the role he took on of being a one-man rapid response team, that as the hearing progressed and allegations that were surfaced from Republicans that were either misleading or just false, Durbin in real time put on the record what happened and the facts surrounding the judge's record. And I think this is important because it's telltale of Durbin's style to be very prepared. Things that came up were anticipated, certainly by the second day, and to have a sense of calm so not to jeopardize getting other Republicans on board. If people are wondering why he didn't act more partisan in the defense of Judge Jackson, he was defending her, but not in a way that may turn off the senators who are most likely to vote for her, particularly Senator Collins of Maine and Murkowski of Alaska. Now, there was a third senator, who is Senator Cruz, who did vote, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who voted to confirm her when she was up last year as a circuit court judge. It seems unlikely Graham will back her this time around.
Yeah, he made some comment this time about her being extreme or radical. I can't remember the exact phrasing. How did the tone of these hearings differ from other ones you've covered in the past? I mean, in some ways, people seem to think this is nomination is pretty surefire. It was praised as a quote unquote mainstream pick, make of that what you will, from President Biden. But I mean, less contentious, more contentious. How do you rate this?
The items that were thrown against her mainly were in the arena of culture wars, not personal conduct. So that alone makes it less incendiary than the hearing to confirm Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Just by the nature of the contentious items at hand, which were, to remind our listeners, questions about his drinking, and an allegation of abusive conduct towards a woman as a younger man. That takes a hearing into just another arena. Now, if you have you had an Amy Coney Barrett who had her confirmation hearing in 2020 near the end of President Trump's term, there were flashpoints also about her writings and her personal and religious beliefs. So I would say that the difference here is that Democrats ran the hearing. For Amy Coney Barrett and Judge Kavanaugh and Justice Gorsuch, the picks from Trump, the Republicans had the majority on the committee. So in this way, we saw a Democratic nominee being shepherded through the confirmation hearing by a Democratic chairman. So where the advantage was in making this less heated is that there is nothing personal on the table.
But as you said, though, these were culture war flashpoints. I was trying to think if critical race theory, either as an academic concept or sort of this popular phrase to mean, you know, teaching and talking about race in schools, has come up in a hearing before. But I guess each of these have their own sort of cultural flashpoints. If it's Democrats, maybe it's on the issue of reproductive health or abortion or something, and Republicans will find their own. So I'm trying to decide, you know, figure in my head how unique is that in the history of how these hearings go.
Well, I wasn't around in this prior centuries to give you a comprehensive comparison.
Nor I.
So here's what I would just urge our listeners. There's a lot to take in just from this one hearing that's happening in real time to analyze and look at. Doing comparisons is harder. As a rule of thumb, the big partisan fights really started, as many of our listeners know, with the nomination of Justice Robert Bork, who never got confirmed. And the sides, the partisan sides, are set going in, and there will be outside groups advocating and protesting the picks. So I think perhaps a way of looking at this is that the confirmation hearings in the last let's just look at the last four picks, Merrick Garland, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Coney Barrett, have been done in a way that is similar to political campaigns. And for the record, as the Republicans complained about this and that, the Democrats, including Durbin, well know that Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky denied President Obama his Supreme Court pick, who is Chicago's very own Lincolnwood raised Merrick Garland, now the Attorney General. Just think, he wouldn't even allow a hearing for Garland.
Yeah.
That is something that I think when the Republicans complained about politics or partisanship, their hands are not clean on this one because of the blocking McConnell did of a presidential Supreme Court pick.
Well, let's talk about politics. What do you think these hearings tell us as we're heading into the 2022 elections and even a number of people on the dais or what have you behind the desks in the committee room are angling for 2024?
These hearings served as a dress rehearsal in the run-up to the 2022 midterms and the 2024 elections. The theme of hitting Democrats as soft on crime, that's a theme already in state of Illinois and local races that's there. And then you do have these cultural war touchdowns, of which Senator Cruz was one of the leaders in the questions of Jackson along those lines. And to make it local and to bring it home, another case study of how the themes you heard in the hearing from Senator Hawley, who kept bringing up this child pornography case, Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee, Ted Cruz of Texas, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, you may see some of this echoed in the Southern Illinois congressional race involving two Republican incumbents, Mary Miller and Rodney Davis. Senator Cruz is endorsing Mary Miller. President Trump has endorsed Mary Miller. So the kind of culture war issues that came up are things that you will see, if you haven't yet, come up in some of the things that Representative Miller is interested in. And we'll see how, and we will probably observe some of this coming up in that primary.
Yeah. And I've already seen Congressman Davis tacking right on some of those issues as well. Last thing I want to ask you about is Madeleine Albright. She died, as you know, of course, last week. She was Secretary of State under President Bill Clinton, the first woman to serve in that role. She was a reporter earlier in life and had her life path set in part by your newspaper, the Chicago Sun-Times. Can you recount that story for us?
Well, thank you for asking. Every time, almost, when I would see Madeleine Albright, she would jab me a little bit about how the Chicago Sun-Times, my newspaper, wouldn't hire her. And that became a turning point in her life. And the story is this. She married Joseph Albright, who comes from the famous family that included, that clan owned the Chicago Tribune. So Joe Albright was a reporter at the Chicago Sun-Times. And Madeleine Albright, one who had worked as a reporter in Rolla, Missouri, and who worked on her college paper when she was at Wellesley, went to one of the top editors. They were at a dinner, and she talked about having a job at the Sun-Times. Now, at that time, there were four newspapers in Chicago. So the editor not only said, "You can't work at the Sun-Times because your husband worked here," but he called her honey, as she would remind me, and that she would write in her own memoir. He called her honey and advised her to just go into another line of work because it wouldn't help her husband's career if she worked at any of the three Chicago papers. So she then went to work for Encyclopedia Britannica, headquartered in Chicago. And then her husband, Joe Albright, got a new job at Newsday in Long Island. It was another paper owned by the company. And to make a very long story short, mm-hmm. she ended up going back to school, getting a bunch of credentials in foreign affairs. And that was the path that led her to becoming President Bill Clinton's nominee for Secretary of State, the first female to have that post. But to bring it home, she never forgot that being rejected for a job at the Sun-Times changed her life. She also said that maybe she should have fought back more. I mean, my God, the guy called her honey and just was dismissing her, basically throwing her out of the journalism profession to help her husband. It's hard to think in our 2022 terms and context of how this would go. But she would never let me forget, as a Sun-Times bureau chief, when we talked, and she'd meant this in a friendly way, of course. She moved on, but she didn't forget.
No, definitely not. Just briefly, we're almost out of time, but what was she like as a person? You've spoken with her a number of times.
Oh, many times. She was warm and friendly, but the insights you could get from her, every sentence told me something I didn't know, or her analysis. Sometimes you talk to officials and it looks like they're reading off of a card of talking points. She would be responsive. You could find out what was going on. And she was funny. I was at multiple events that she's at. And unlike some people I cover, she had a good sense of humor, but she also knew what she was talking about. And her gift was explaining these complex foreign relation matters in a very understandable way.
In a commanding presence, I've read, even though she was not necessarily a commanding height person.
She was not intimidating.
Yeah.
She because she had a warmth about her, she was a giant, yes, but she would deal with people in a one-on-one situation in a way that I was quite rare as I go around. I've dealt with local state and federal officials up and down from alderman to the White House. Not everybody does this, what she does, which is just treat people in a way where they don't use what they know could be their intimidating presence to leverage it. She had just a good sense of who she was and where she's been and how mm-hmm. she wants to approach dealing with people. Instructive for us all.
Yeah. Lynn Sweet is Washington Bureau Chief at the Chicago Sun-Times. Lynn, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.
More to come after a short break. You're listening to The 21st Show. We're going to be talking to Amanda Vinicky about Illinois state government and politics. Do stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we turn now to state government and politics. The Illinois General Assembly's spring legislative session is scheduled to wrap up in just a couple of weeks, April 8th. To talk more about what's in store, we're joined by Amanda Vinicky. She's a correspondent for the program Chicago Tonight on PBS station WTTW. Amanda, how are you? Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Brian. I'm doing all right. Getting run up for that whole end of session bit.
Oh, my goodness.
The final week slogs. Yeah.
Listeners, you can always join us if you have a question about the General Assembly and what's in store. 800-222-9455 is the number to call. 800-222-9455. So, Amanda, one of the big stories in the past couple of weeks has been this gap in the unemployment insurance trust fund. I think I said that right. What is that? What is it issue there? And what did the General Assembly, what are they looking at doing?
So it's pretty much done for now anyway. The question is what is to come in the future, because that could mean either a reduction in unemployment benefits at a time where, yikes, we don't know what's going to happen. And of course, nobody hopes it'll come to this, but where a recession is certainly a possibility and therefore higher unemployment rates, or also increased taxes on business owners at a time where they say they're having a hard time, of course, coming out of or trying to come out of a pandemic. And so really what you have is a big debt in Illinois' unemployment insurance trust fund. What is that? Basically, that is the fund that pays for unemployment benefits, and that fund grew into a deficit when you had a whole lot of people, of course, claiming that, filing for unemployment, especially given the start of the pandemic, you had shutdowns, economic turmoil, and whatnot. Further, and this is something that I suspect we're going to hear more about, Republicans are going to try and push for this because, of course, there's a campaign, but it is an outstanding issue in Illinois, as with other states, but we don't still have a true accounting, really, of the amount of fraudulent claims that were made. So you had this fund grow a big deficit, $4.5 billion. Illinois decided to use some of, really a large chunk of its remaining ARPA money, that federal COVID relief money, to pay down the that deficit. So $2.7 billion will be going toward writing that off, but that's only about 60%. So that's where, as I mentioned earlier, it's going to have to be paid somehow, some way. And by the way, the longer you wait, there's also insurance hits. So it's half resolved, half not, but it is a big chunk of the budget discussion and certainly had been a premier issue for businesses that are wanting to plan, worried about their tax liabilities. And it may not be something that to most folks is particularly obvious or that they care about on the daily, but it certainly will or could become such later on down the road if anybody needs to file for unemployment and they see their benefits not lasting as much. And by the way, it is sort of a question to be folded in as Governor J.B. Pritzker running for re-election in terms of he's saying that he's been a great fiscal steward of Illinois' finances. And in fact, just have a civic federation give nod to his FY23 budget proposal. This one, though, is an area where it seems as if had Illinois made the choice sooner, would have had less money in interest and perhaps not been as much a cross for the state businesses or those who are unemployed to have born.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, bottom line here, there's three ways to fix this. Either businesses pay more, individuals getting unemployment get less, or the state finds the money in some other way. So still some outstanding gap there. What about motor fuel tax? This seems, or sales tax, without necessarily having to conduct an entire seminar on the varieties of taxes. We know gas prices are high. There's some effort at relief. Is there any settlement yet? And how much, I mean, can people expect a noticeable drop in the price they're paying for gas with whatever happens?
I think the short answer of that is no, in terms of a noticeable drop. Certainly, again, I will have to repeat this over and over for months. We are in election season. And of course, those increases in what folks are paying for gas hits people at home. Think about it. It hits a lot of categories. It hits businesses. It hits school districts as you're looking at, the money that it costs for a school bus to run. So there's all of that. As you noted, we'll not conduct a seminar, but let's lay it like this. In Illinois in particular, you're not just paying for gas, wherever it comes from, you're also paying a whole lot of taxes. Stateside, if you live where I do in Chicago, there's a city, there's a Cook County tax, and there are several levers of them. There is both a sales tax, just like you pay on, you know, most other goods that you purchase, as well as a motor fuel tax. And so the question is, will any of those be at least temporarily eliminated or artificially held down? The governor has wanted to hold in line the motor fuel tax. Sort of ironic because he's the one that signed the law that tied that motor fuel tax to inflation. And obviously, with inflation particularly high right now, that motor fuel tax going to be, I mean, again, not particularly when you're paying at the pump, you're not necessarily going to notice how much higher, but it adds in. Everything adds up there. So that's one of the questions, but he's getting pushback from unions, of course, big Democratic allies on this, because that is money that funds road and other construction projects, which again, rising in cost due to increase in inflation. So still unsettled. Certainly you have the governor wanting to be able to claim tax relief. He's looking at some other areas for that too. But I think we're going to be hearing a lot of talk both on the state, local, and federal level about what can be done to bring gas prices down, including, again, some temporarily holds on what would otherwise be increases or current taxes on gasoline.
Yeah, I mean, look, nobody likes paying high gas prices, even though I drive a hybrid. But still, and we're talking about maybe a few cents on, per gallon of gas. I was reminded recently of something that then U.S. Senator, former President Obama said back in 2008. He was campaigning against Hillary Clinton at the time still. And John McCain was also, I think he had sealed up the nomination. And they were both calling for some sort of suspension of the federal gas tax for that summer of 2008, heading into the Great Recession. And he said, "We're arguing over a gimmick that would save you half a tank of gas over the course of the entire summer so that everyone in Washington can pat themselves on the back and say they did something. Well, let me tell you, this isn't an idea designed to get you through the summer. It's designed to get them through an election," said Obama. That's from a CBS News report. We can just leave that.
Obama has a way with words, right? There you
sure
go.
So another story you've been following in terms of state government relates to COVID testing sites, community COVID testing sites. The free testing sites are closing down. What's going on there?
So the state says that there has just been a precipitous drop-off in folks using them. While you had, for a stretch, I'm sure we can all remember, lines, having folks wanting to get there as early as possible, and more than 1,000 people being tested and having a swab stuck up their nostril every day, that has now gone to somewhere along 50. And further, the state says that, well, there are plenty of other options at this point, be it the federal government sending people in the mail at home tests, or reimbursement from insurers when you buy them at a store, or the state also having this combination with your employer, at least to venture out of it in terms of the shield testing, the ones where you spit in a tube, the saliva COVID tests. And so these will be gone, but also a handful of them, there had been, by the way, something like, I don't know, dozens of these community sites at a time. Now there's really about 10, a handful of which had also been offering vaccines. And so they're going to be closing down in a matter of days. But what's interesting here, though, is, of course, that this comes as you have changeover at IDPH, no longer Dr. Ngozi Ezike, who had become this household name there, and also continued questions about what is to come next with the pandemic, this BA.2 variant, what is going to be happening there. And I think, at least in Chicago, also questions about some of these private sites, given that there has been reporting that, oh, wait, some of those swab tests didn't actually ever get tested. There was false answers. And so these community testing sites had been some of the areas where you were really able to trust in your results, have access for free without any questions asked.
Okay. Well, any other big issues you're watching in the final couple of weeks of legislative session?
Oh, sure. I mean, there are going to be just rows of bills that I expect will move through in short order, while the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund is, at least for now, partially taken care of and tabled. There remains this budget question. And again, as we talked about gas tax and other relief, what will be a part of that? How much of that will be political, and how much of that would actually make a difference in people's lives? And finally, we've also had Democrats promising action on crime and doing something about that, but we do not yet have any proposal to know what that might look like. And again, whether that will satiate both members, particularly Democrats who control the Illinois House and Senate, as well as voters who we're aware from polling are certainly concerned about crime.
Amanda Vinicky is a correspondent for Chicago Tonight on PBS station WTTW. Amanda, great to talk with you. Thanks for being with us.
It was my pleasure, and great to have followed the one and only Lynn Sweet.